Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey guys, it's Johnny and welcome to episode 121 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I'm still in Kharkiv, Ukraine. Sam, you look like you're back in time in your university dorm. Where are you?
Yes, I am. I got my hat on backwards. I got my sunnies on, Bose speakers, and basically some. You know who makes this shirt, Johnny? Can you see this? I got it at Target.
Yeah. Okay.
$14. That's a nice shirt. It every day. It's amazing.
Does it not have buttons?
Nice quality.
Is there a reason why it's completely unbuttoned?
It's because we're. Because I know you like me looking suave.
Nice.
I'm in Florida now, so I'm that beach boy again.
Yeah, you definitely fit the boy. Part.
Yeah. You learned how to say hello in Ukraine yet?
Da. Zhdravstvuyte. Kak dela? Dobry den.
I'm not going to be learning that language anytime soon.
It's going to be kind of
hard. I can barely say hi in Spanish.
Yeah. Well, it's been a good journey. Actually, yesterday was the first time I ever saw myself speaking Russian. I was practicing out loud and I went to go brush my teeth. And I just saw myself in the mirror, like speaking Russian, and it looked so awkward because it's just this weird language coming out of me. It was almost like I was possessed or something.
Yeah, you look like you look Mongolian, so I could see it sounding the part.
Yeah, but I just look like a different person. Like it's not Johnny. It's like Genghis Johnny.
Genghis, yes, Genghis. And maybe we'll start calling you Genghis Jen from now on.
Yeah, Genghis FD.
Well, as you know, I'm heading over to Lithuania next week, so we'll be pretty close. And I've really found it amusing telling people I'm going to Lithuania because almost everyone has the exact same response in South Florida.
Like, where is that? Or
with Lithuania? What? Yeah, they don't know it's a country or a part of Russia or what it is. And no one knows where it's located.
Yeah, I know. I'm pretty sure you cannot put it on a map. And if you gave a blank map to 100 Americans, maybe one can actually point to where it is.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Well, here I come to the Baltics.
Yeah, and I will be joining you there very, very soon. So you're going to be there like pretty much next week, right?
Yeah, May 26th to June 27th.
Okay.
And you're coming out the 22nd of June, right?
Yeah, so I'll be out there June 22nd to the 29th. So if any of you bosses want to meet up in I don't even know how to say it. Vilnius, Lithuania, between the 22nd of June to the 27th of June, Sam and I would both be there so we can meet up for dinner or coffee or maybe some
beers.
Drinks. Definitely drinks.
Dude, why do you start with the boring stuff? Yeah. Go straight to the beers.
Definitely drinks. Yeah, and if you guys don't want to fly all the way to Lithuania, wherever that is in the world, you guys can meet us in Vegas. It's probably much easier for everybody. That's going to be in September, the last week of September, the 28th and 29th. Go to the Boss Lounge on Facebook and look for our event, Invest Like a Boss Summit. It's going to be the 28th, 29th of September. And if you RSVP on our Facebook event, we can give you the details as we get more people signed up. So for us to be able to kind of start looking at sponsors, start looking at renting a venue, we need a high count of people who are at least interested. So please, if you guys are at all interested, RSVP to that, tell your friends. That way we can get a good head count for how many people want to go, and potentially we can get some sponsors on board to help pay for the venue.
Looking forward to this very much. No place like doing a business money-making conference than Vegas. I went out to Money 2020 last year, had to riot. Can't wait to get back out there.
Yeah, I can imagine it'd be super fun. And make sure you stay a few days afterwards. I don't know if you're making your travel plans yet, but I'm thinking that maybe the Tuesday after, not like directly after because Monday is hangover day. Maybe Tuesday we can go to one of the exotic car racetracks where you can just rent like a Ferrari or Lamborghini or McLaren for a few laps on the track. And I think all the
that would
bosses
be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it'd be fun because all the bosses can go out. We can just take turns driving cars and just hanging out.
Sounds great. Let's do it. And in the meantime, we'll be making passive income. And this week we have brought you, I wouldn't say it's a new asset class. It's actually a new way to access an asset class that was a little bit down the line for me in my real estate investing journey. So what we're going to talk about this week, we're going to have on Tim Wallen who is the CEO of MLG Capital. It's a private real estate fund that operates out kind of in the Midwest. They also focus a lot in Florida, Texas, Wisconsin. And this is a great way to access property investing that I really didn't know. I guess I knew it existed, but I thought it was for the super exclusive, you know, elite country club guys, right? But kind of with all of this real estate investing that we've been discussing over the last year or two, I've just found that this is a much more accessible asset class than one would typically think, right? Johnny, have you ever taken a look at any of this stuff?
Yeah, to be honest, it's been a little bit out of my league still because the minimums are usually pretty high. But I think it's one of those things where I like that it's gone easier now with different funds and different REITs. But I'm sure there's a lot of pros and cons of having, you know, the online funds or having, you know, like the stock market based REITs. So I'm excited to kind of learn more about it. So I think this is one of those topics where not every single person listening is going to be like high enough net worth or accredited to be able to invest in these. But I think all of us can learn how it actually works as either something to strive for or something to at least understand versus other types of investments.
This is going to be a highly educational, highly informative episode. I think you guys are going to learn a lot by listening to Tim speak about real estate investing, some of the pros and cons to being a private fund versus a public REIT, like Johnny mentioned, and just kind of hearing about the journey. MLG's been in business for a long time. They've been through a lot of ups and downs in terms of markets. And I think this is something that it's very exciting to me in terms of an asset. And I've enjoyed the journey so far. I've been invested in a few of these funds now for about 6 months. And I'm definitely looking to increase my activity in this. So I hope you guys enjoy this episode with Tim. Stay tuned afterwards. Johnny and I will be back with some takeaways and some of our own real estate investing pursuits.
All right. Here's Tim Wallen with MLG Capital.
Everyone, welcome back. I have on an excellent guest today, Tim Wallen of MLG Capital. Tim, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, great to be here, Sam.
We're excited to have you on. This is a unique episode for us. It's actually a unique asset class to the show in a lot of ways. And I was turned on to this by one of our listeners after talking about some real estate funds. Started looking into it, had a conversation, I believe, with Steve previously and ended up investing with you guys. So I'm really excited to have you guys on the show. And maybe as kind of an introduction, we could get just a little bit of background about MLG Capital and how you guys got started and what the journey's been so far.
Sure. Well, MLG has been around for over 30 years, and that is it's great to be part of an organization that's got that kind of depth of history. But overall, we've done about 18 million square feet of acquisitions, about 14,000 apartment units. Today we have about $1 billion under management and assets. You know, I'm an old Pricewaterhouse guy. I was a tax manager at Pricewaterhouse out in San Francisco. These guys were my clients when I came back from California back to Wisconsin in 1988. Joined them in 89 as a CFO and one of the junior partners back in 89, and then took over the leadership role in the year 2000. But we have a very professional team. We have 8 CPAs on staff, 5 attorneys, over 300 employees in the organization, but a very deep, talented team that brings a great diversity of, you know, talents and backgrounds and expertise to, you know, create the best returns possible for our investors that are really tax advantaged. So it's exciting to be part of this group. It's fun to be part of this group, overall.
That's incredible. I had no idea you guys were around for 30 years. And I didn't even know that an individual investor like myself, although accredited, had access to these types of funds. And now every time I go around and I look at, say, a multifamily development complex or student housing, I start to think about, well, somebody owns these assets, someone owns these properties. And a lot of times it's a fund similar to MLG. Isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's common. I mean, the industry, you know, it's a very fractured, fragmented industry, and there's many different ways people approach investing in private real estate. I would say the fund model is much more common on the institutional side of investing, you know, the pension funds, insurance companies and whatnot. I would say bulk of the real estate industry is done what I describe as individual syndications. Local real estate guy finds a local deal and raises local capital. That has changed with the crowdfunding that you're seeing more capital raised nationwide for local real estate operators around the country. So that does change the model, you know, as things going forward. And you don't see as many funds that are targeted towards a high net worth, you know, single family office, you know, in type of environment or IRAs. Most of the funds are really institutionally based. So what we're doing is really a little more unique in creating a fund that's really open to the high net worth community.
Now, how would you classify MLG in just a few words? Is it a private real estate fund, or do you typically use a different way to classify it or phrase it?
I would say in general, what makes MLG extremely unique is we're your traditional vertically integrated real estate operator, you know, doing property management. You know, we fix toilets, you know, we get snow shoveled, we get grass cut, but we also are a very sophisticated group and we act as a private equity firm, and we're willing to invest with other real estate operators around the country. So you know, we're typically doing that. So that what makes us extremely unique is that we're both a private equity firm and a vertically integrated real estate operator with 30 years of history of operations, which makes us extremely unique in the investment space. Most real estate companies are, you know, the vertically integrated real estate operators, and generally the capital raised people or people that invest with operators, you know, might be a money allocator from San Francisco or Boston or New York that's putting money to work, but those groups typically aren't operational folks.
Mm. Over the course of the last 30 years, has the strategy to attract capital changed for you guys? I think a lot of people listening to this, including myself, would think that this is kind of like a country club style of membership, kind of mm-hmm. elite membership, where you have to know somebody and it's kind of just word of mouth to get into these funds. Is that a part of it? And has any of this evolved over the last kind of 30 years?
Oh, I mean, the advent, I think the biggest thing is in the advent of the internet and crowdfunding. I know they did change the rules that allow real estate guys like ourselves to do general solicitation. That changed with the Jobs Act a couple years back. So the world and securities world has changed dramatically in the last, you know, really the last 5 to 10 years with the advent of all the online products. Because traditionally it was local real estate guys finding local deals and raising the money at the country club like you referenced. And that was the typical model for the bulk of our industry.
Now, at MLG, what kind of properties do you guys specialize in? I think I know this, but I don't want to assume too much.
You know, I like that question, because our industry, the traditional institutional world, they want to pigeonhole real estate companies into one asset class. You're a multifamily guy. You're a retail guy. You're an office guy. You're an industrial guy. And you can't do both. That's the institutional mindset. And I really think that is really a poor way for real estate companies to think about it. What we like to say is I want to focus on smart real estate deals. I could care less what asset class it is. I just want to make sure it's a good deal and there's a great story to grow value. I mean, ultimately, when I say smart real estate deals, it's about, is there an asset? Is this asset that we're buying? Can we grow our operating income? Can we grow revenue? Can we reduce expenses? If I can grow the bottom line, if I can grow the EBITDA, or the net operating income, if I can do that, I know I'm going to grow the value of my investment. So we're a little agnostic as far as which asset class we like to invest in. And we do have a bias, though. I mean, I don't mislead you. Because we have a heavy bias towards multifamily and industrial versus retail and office. And the reason we have a bias to multifamily and industrial properties is I would describe them as low CapEx businesses, meaning that as tenants come and go, our cost of replacing a tenant is dramatically less in multifamily and industrial. In retail and office, if a tenant leaves an office building, they expect you to recreate and give them this remodeled space like you're remodeling your home. And make this space new and sexy for the new office guy. So, and you know, an office guy leaves, you typically are spending, you know, 40, 50, 60 bucks a square foot to put a new tenant in an office space. Whereas multifamily, you know, you're cleaning the carpet, changing the carpet, doing some paint, you might spend $6 or $7 a square foot. So it's a dramatically different profile of risk as far as tenants coming and going. So we have a high preference towards multifamily and industrial assets. In retail and office, We view those assets, as I describe, as merchant asset classes, meaning that if we like retail, we like office, if it's in a great location, if it's got some vacancy problem that we think we can fix, we like to buy somebody's problem, fix the problem, sell the asset as fast as we can, because holding on to retail and office has a lot of capital cost turn as tenants come and go. That can be somewhat mitigated by longer lease terms, but in general, I'm generalizing here, that it's trickier investing in retail and office because of those high turnover costs, high CapEx costs as tenants come and go.
That's really interesting, Tim. I've never thought about it in that way. And why is it like that for industrial? Is it because everyone comes in and wants to do something specific for their industrial needs?
Well, no, industrial is not very, typically the industrial guys are more down and dirty. They don't necessarily need a lot of capital costs. So it's industrial and multifamily are the low CapEx side. It's retail, you know, commercial retail stuff or office buildings where you have a high CapEx. The industrial guys are pretty willing to accept, you know, average condition space, and they're looking to build stuff, make stuff, and they don't necessarily need the same sex appeal as a retailer or an office guy as far as their physical presence, you know, overall.
They seem like good guys to work with. Just kind of stroke the check, get in there, build something, get their hands dirty.
Yeah.
Seem like good guys to go have a beer with afterwards also.
Yeah, you got it, especially for guys in Wisconsin.
So, Tim, how do you guys go about acquiring properties? Imagine you're looking at a lot of properties at any given time. You mentioned you look for smart properties or smart, you know, smart assets. You know, what's your general acquisition strategy when looking at all these?
You know, when we define what does it mean by being smart, I think a core concept to think about is, are your assumptions that you're making believable and achievable? Because, you know, I'm a CPA kind of guy, right? And we have 8 CPAs on staff here. And, you know, it's not hard for us to make an assumption or modification in a spreadsheet to make the numbers look good. But the question is, can you really deliver on those assumptions that you're making? Is, if you're assuming rent's going to grow 6%, is there a reason you can justify 6% when inflation is 2 or 3%? Why do you think you can move rent 6%? And, you know, that's a key thing, being smart. So how we do that and how we source stuff is really two ways. We have our traditional, I call it, it's more of our direct strategy, meaning when I talk about MLG and being this vertically integrated real estate company, which is a common structure for many companies in the country, I think Wisconsin, Texas, and Florida. We've been in those markets for 30 years. We have multiple relationships. We understand the submarkets well, and we have 30 years of relationships that bring us opportunities. The key for the best real estate deals, it's, you know, somebody that's somehow getting you an opportunity for buying this asset, and for whatever reason, is at a number that makes economic sense. And relationships are a monster as far as sourcing opportunities. I will say the most difficult thing I've done in my over 30 years of being in this business is sourcing great deals. It is really super difficult, and you cannot, can't put a bunch of frosting on this one. This is a tough, challenging issue for real estate guys. And so that is the core reason why we also are a private equity firm. I am very willing, and our company is very willing, to invest in other operators around the country, because I'll use Minneapolis, for example. There's a deal called Crossroads, and that deal was owned by a gentleman that lived in Naples full-time, owned the asset for 30 years, this local operator named Jim that knew this gentleman. And you know, Jim had the relationship with the gentleman that lived in Naples full-time, and we didn't know this guy, but we were willing to invest in Jim's company because, one, it was a great opportunity, but we talked to Jim for 3 years about his deals, never did a deal with him. But then Jim calls us one day and say, this 80-year-old gentleman from Naples is now willing to sell this $41 million asset off market to us. Can you help me buy this deal? Because the deal was too big for Jim. And so we get this deal done, and it's a phenomenal opportunity, and we won't get too big of a tangent here. But the key message here is that Jim had 15 years of relationship with this gentleman, this 80-year-old gentleman. And for 15 years, Jim was trying to get the gentleman to sell this asset to him. And because we proactively travel the country, meeting with real estate operators about their deals, we saw that opportunity. And had we not been willing to do that, you know, and not be willing to invest with other people and be joint venture minded, you know, willing to partner with others, we never would have got that opportunity. And that's what makes MLG extremely unique in our industry, is that we are a private equity firm willing to invest with other operators from the country that gives us an incredible amount of deal flow that we not would not other have had. Typical real estate company has, you know, one to two, maybe three acquisition people. We traditionally had two or three people, but we opened the private equity strategy. We actually have a team of about 15 people that are involved in the chase and pursuit of opportunities around the country from all these operators. And we see 50 or 60 deals a month from these other real estate guys. And these are 50 or 60 deals that real estate guy believes you should give him your money. And these are signed contracts, signed letter of intent, deals that MLG never would have saw otherwise. And we're looking to invest in one or two of those. So a great critical selection process. And that's very unique to our space, you know, overall. So that to me is our what makes us unique, is this being this direct real estate firm, vertically integrated. We fix toilets, we shovel snow, we cut grass, but we also act as a very sophisticated private equity firm and willing to invest with other real estate guys around the country.
Now, I'm sure you guys have taken a look at the potentials of being a public REIT versus a private real estate fund of sorts. Could you give us a little bit of info on why you might stay private versus going public, or what the advantages of being public or private are for as a fund and for investors?
You know, I think most public REITs became public REITs to get access to capital. You know, I don't feel the need to be public to get access to capital. If you continue to do smart real estate deals, money flows your way. So we don't feel the need to be public. Frankly, it's a distraction, and you know, you're operating quarter to quarter versus, you know, longer term. A lot of times when we buy assets, you know, initially you're losing money because if you're turning over an apartment complex and you're gonna upgrade it, you typically lose occupancy, you know, for a period of time because you're upgrading an asset. And that's part of the goal of creating the returns. And, you know, when you're a public company, you're more sensitive to quarterly performance. And so I think it's a real advantage not being public in overall. Mm-hmm. So the main driver for being public is really just access to capital. And if you can get plenty of capital not being public, then why would you go through the brain damage of all the filings and public recording and all that kind of good stuff? And it takes you off the eye off the ball. I mean, our focus is buying smart real estate deals. And, you know, if I had to worry about all the public reporting stuff, it's another distraction from, you know, our core focus.
So if we flip that over, Tim, as an investor, I'm sure you've invested in all types of real estate yourself. Do you believe, or maybe even for your own preference, that investing in private real estate deals or private real estate funds is a better opportunity for investors than a public REIT outside of the fact of having kind of immediate liquidity in a public REIT?
Yeah, I mean, I view public REITs, even though there's real estate underneath them, as a very different asset class than private real estate. And the big driver there is public REITs are highly correlated to the S&P 500. So stock market volatility will definitely come into and impact the public REIT space. So you have this volatility issue that you get in the valuation of your assets. So there's a price to that liquidity. The price of liquidity is volatility, and that's okay. I mean, some people need to be liquid, and private real estate isn't an illiquid asset. So you shouldn't be putting money into private real estate if you can't let it sit 6, 8, 10 years because you don't know what's going to happen. It could be a cycle where you just don't want to sell. You have to be willing to wait, and you have to be willing to hold that illiquid investment. So you have to be willing to tolerate that. But public REITs have volatility that private real estate does not. The stock market dropped like in December, and the stock market dropped, you know, whatever, 10%, whatever it was, more like 15% in a very short period of time. I guarantee private real estate didn't drop at all in that same period. So there's that volatility issue. The other issue is private real estate. There was a study done by Standard & Poor's that compared all asset classes and how they performed in inflationary cycles. And private real estate beat every asset class. It beat gold, beat owning a home, significantly beat REITs, significantly beat stock market. We could send you that report sometime if you ever want to see it, and bonds as well. And the main reason it can beat it is private real estate has the benefit of leases turning over, and when leases turn over, we have the ability to raise rents. And we can raise rents with inflation, and that grows the value of the underlying asset, and it grows our operating income and offset the effect, the negative effect of inflation. Generally, the big driver of asset deflation value is interest rates going up because of inflation. And when you have interest rates go up, the multiples on that's used in ratios used for valuation go to change as well. So that's a major thing. So volatility versus illiquidity, inflation hedge. And the last probably thing is just the tax advantages. You can't, there's some significant tax advantages for highly compensated people that you get in private real estate investing that you just don't get from public REITs.
Very educational stuff, Tim. Thank you. Now, when I went through kind of the investing process with MLG, signed the subscription agreement, commit to whatever I was committed to, and then you guys did a capital call in which send all the money in, and you then invested in the fund. Also invested in another fund what was similar, but they did a capital call in a phased approach, mm-hmm. which whatever my subscription agreement was, so far they've only called, I think, maybe 10 or 12%. And the rest is supposed to be deployed maybe over the next 12 months. But I'm wondering what the, you know, what the strategy is for the funds. You know, personally, I like getting all my money deployed quick, so I don't have to kind of to think about it or plan for it. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure there's a reason on the fund side for doing it either way.
Sure. So what you're describing is really the institutional model that you see in the pension fund world, insurance world, and the very high net worth area. Most institutional funds have an entry point of about $5 million or more because they have to have qualified investors. But so you typically see that in institutional space. So what happens is they spend roughly 12 months organizing the commitments typically, and then another 2 to 3 years to deploy that capital. So what happens is your money sits there for, you know, 2-3 years waiting for your money to get invested. And maybe some groups move faster, but I'd say the bulk of them, it's a solid 2-3 year process. So our viewpoint, because MLG's capital's built this organization to be that outsourced manager for high net worth folks, single family offices and RRAs around the country, where they can invest with us and get a diversified pool of private real estate get a diversified pool. But big picture, most people in our space that we focus in, the high net worth folks, even RRAs and single family office world, they have money today and they want to put that money deployed today. Just like you just said, you like the idea that your money got put to work. And because most folks in that space don't want to wait 2-3 years, we do a different process where money gets called immediately as we are buying assets. So if somebody wants the money, do the money over time, they still can in our funds. You just break up your subscription into 3 to 4 buckets. So if a guy wanted to invest $1 million, he can invest $250,000 every 6 months if he wants to spread it over 2 years. But we give people the ability to put it all to work immediately as we're closing deals.
Now, Tim, for a more seasoned investor, I'm sure the DD process would be a lot more involved looking at management fee structures. For someone like myself who kind of, you know, highly diversified, but also in a lot of different asset classes. So I'm not an expert in any master asset class per se. Looking at the management fee structures, I did some quick browsing and I mm-hmm. reviewed your guys and compared to some recommendations online. And it seemed like you guys had a great management fee structure. Mm-hmm. Is there I know this could get very lengthy and probably be an episode on its own, but are there a few things that you guys particularly think align the fund's interest and the investor's interest when looking at fee structures that an investor should be aware of?
Yeah, you have to kind of the whole package. I mean, there's the asset management fees, and we only charge 1.25% on invested capital. Many funds charge 1.5 to 2%, and it also is on committed capital. What I mean by that, if you got a $1 billion fund that's committed, they get to charge the 1.5% on the whole $1 billion, even though they've only invested $100 million of the billion. Oh. And so in our example, we only charge 1.25%. If it was 100 million, we charge 1.25% on 100 million. We don't get to charge 1.25% on another 900 million that hasn't been put to work yet. So many, many funds are on committed capital, not invested capital. There are some funds out there that are really gross, meaning that they charge the fee on asset value. So it, you know, our funds are 65% debt, 35% equity. Our 1.25 on that 35% equity side. Some funds are charging, they're saying 1% on the asset value, making it look lower than our 1.25, but 1% on the asset value is charging the 1% on the debt piece too. So they're charging effectively 3%, you know, if you're roughly 1/3 equity, charging 3% on the equity. So you do have to understand the basis on which you're charging it. I'd say that I call it the fairness test. The biggest thing that we do is what I call the European waterfall, which means that in a European waterfall structure, not everybody might understand what I just said, but we give the investors 100% of the cash flow until they get an 8% return on their money and all their money back. And then after all the money's back, the 100% capital back and preferred return, 8% preferred return, we get 30% of the upside, and the investors get 70% of the upside. So many funds, that's not how it works. If we sell an asset and we make $10 million on an asset, now, in theory, 30% of $10 million is $3 million that is coming to us maybe someday. Most funds allow the real estate guy to put his hand in the till and take the $3 million profit and put it in their pocket when that asset sells. That's the traditional waterfall model allows them to do that. In our example, we don't get to do that because we follow the European waterfall structure so that the money stays in the fund. So that $3 million of profit that was really kind of ours, we don't get it yet. It actually goes back to return the capital first. So the investors in the waterfall, European waterfall model, is we have to get all the money back and a 8% rate of return until we see any material money from our performance. And what that does is it forces us to pay 100% focus on the entire portfolio all the way to the finish line, because our profits are all buried in those last, you know, whatever, 20% of the assets that we sell, where we start getting a good chunk of the money, but we don't see it until all people's money's back. I don't know if I made that clear enough for everybody.
No, that was very well explained. It's something that I, for one, will have to go back and listen to, but it seems like that would be the logical way to structure things. I don't know if that's the most common way, if there's a lot of...
It's not common. Traditional waterfall is the real estate guy puts his hand in that $3 million example I just gave you. They put it in, they put it in their pocket. And there could be some clauses that allow them, that force them to put some of that back, you know, 5, 8, 10 years from now. But, you know, the investors lost the benefit of that money in their pocket. And it's just a much fairer structure, you know, overall for the investor. But it is not common in our industry. There's another thing you got to watch out for. There's only one other fund that I know about that's doing anything similar to us as far as being a private equity firm and a vertically integrated company. They don't have a 30-year history; they got a 5-year history of operating. But in any case, they have more of a private equity model, meaning that they have what's called a catch-up clause, where after the 8% return has been paid, let's say it's a 9% preferred rate of return, and it's 80-20 split over the 9. But what happens in this is a European model, in that after the investors got their 9%, the sponsor of that fund gets 100% of the cash flow until the cumulative split on cash flow is now 80-20. So the effect of it is that if you achieve returns over 9%, that there's effectively no preferred rate of return. Because ultimately, all cash flow will be split 80-20 as long as you go over the 9% rate of return. The net effect of that, it's almost like 1.75% per year additional return going to the sponsor above and beyond the asset management fee. But yet their face preferred rate of return is 9%, ours is 8%. And they think that, and the marketplace is getting fooled a little bit. They're thinking, oh, they're getting 9% and MLG is only paying 8%. But the reality is, it's costing another 1.7% a year because that fund's got a catch-up clause, meaning that all cash flows catch up 80-20 until all cash flow cumulatively is 80-20. I don't know, if you got that one as well. So, you know, catch-up clauses are something to watch out for when you look at structures.
Now, Tim, is for the tax advantages for the individual investor, is most of that on the upside, the capital gains upside when the property is liquidated, and or if the fund is liquidated in years to come, or is that also on the preferred return that's paid out quarterly?
You know, again, every organization is different skills as far as being tax advantaged. We're very focused on being tax advantaged. I mean, first and foremost, do smart real estate deals, but then why not do great tax planning? And that's the benefit of having eight CPAs on staff here. But big picture, you are able to, we do cost segregation studies, which allow us to allocate purchase price on a variety of asset classes that have shorter depreciation lives. So in all four of our funds, even though, well, fund one, two, and three are all current on the 8% preferred rate of return, all three of those funds have cumulative ordinary losses, i.e. none of the preferred rate of return that we paid was taxed on a current basis. It was all tax deferred. It's still owed in the future. The government eventually gets you, but it's tax deferred until we actually start selling assets. So we're creating current yields and not having to pay any current tax on those yields by taking advantage of all the different aspects that are available, you know, in the tax code.
Now, is there any growth limitations to MLG, like in terms of size? If you get to a certain size, do you have to turn public, or can you guys grow, you know, basically forever? Do you guys have goals out there for how big you want to get, or, you know, where do you currently sit in your corporate objectives?
You know, growth in our, the biggest limiter of growth is the availability of smart deals. We're not looking just to buy huge volume. We're looking to make money. We're not, you know, it's not a volume game. We are comfortable that we can consistently, you know, put $200 to $400 million of equity to work every, you know, 24 months or so. And the key to that, again, it gets back to our private equity strategy, the fact that they're willing to invest with other operators around the country. As things get more difficult, we'll expand our geography. I mean, right now we're chasing in about 14 to 15 states, and we're looking to increase that geography over time and increase our scale. But, you know, we have over 1,000 real estate companies that we're talking to around the country now about their deals. And so, you know, and those 1,000 companies have many, many relationships, and they find opportunities. And so the growth limitation is really more driven by the availability of smart deals. We're clearly in a more stable investment environment right now. And right now, critical selection is of the utmost importance right now. You know, you buy in 2011, 12, 13, it's hard not to make money, right? Because you're buying at the bottom and on the way up. And now we're in a stable environment, and now having good strategies for sourcing becomes critical in this, you know, stabilized environment.
Well, we talk a lot about just, you know, reviewing our own personal investment portfolios. There's always winners and losers in the bunch, but at least Johnny and I certainly have our favorite investment, either one that is the most profitable or just the most enjoyable to be a part of. Of all the properties that you guys have, all the assets that you guys have, is there one that stands out that you're just like, wow, that's just fantastic. It's just worked out so well. You have kind of a favorite property or asset in your portfolios?
I got to go back to that story I told a little bit earlier about my buddy Jim and the gentleman from Naples. That deal was called Crossroads. 698 units. Right across from Best Buy's headquarters in Minneapolis. Many, many cars a day driving by there. It's like 100,000 cars a day driving by there. So great visibility. Asset built in the mid-60s, early 70s. Beautiful orange countertops and just beautiful design from the 60s and 70s. Hadn't been touched. And a great location. We bought the asset for $41 million. And you think about this, $41 million asset. We didn't compete against anybody to buy the asset. It was not an open auction, an open bid. You know, when we're selling multifamily assets right now, it's typical to get 30 offers for that asset. And you think about the juxtapose of competing against 30 parties to buy an asset versus just negotiating one-on-one, dramatically different. So, I mean, that, the gentleman made a mistake selling it to us that way. But that there's also a mistake the gentleman made, and he didn't take advantage of the opportunity. We bought the property. The rents were roughly call it $725 a month for one bedroom. We spent about $20,000 per unit, or $14 million, you know, fixing up these units, making old new again. You know, granite countertops, you know, wood laminate flooring, incredible amenity packages, just over the top repositioning of the asset. You know, today the rents are $1,130 a month on that same asset. So you have $400 a month. Most of that gross revenue falls to the bottom line. we grew our EBITDA, or net operating income, from $2.5 million to $5.8 million in 2.5 years' time. Just crazy, crazy value growth. So we bought it for $41 million, all in $17 million of improvements, all in for $58 million. We just sold it a couple months ago for $95 million in a matter of 2.5-3 years. Crazy good. Best deal I've seen or done in ages. And just a ton of fun, too.
Great for the European waterfall for both parties.
Yeah, and on that deal and the fund, we didn't get any money on that sale, you know? Oh. And our investors got all that money because the money went back to return you know, the original equity in the fund. So we haven't seen the glory of that sale yet in our pockets, which gets back to, you know, the whole keeps us motivated on the rest of the assets, right? We got to perform.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tim, now when I drive around, my eyes are just open whenever time I mentioned this at the beginning of the episode, but every time I see, you know, even the condo building I'm in Tampa, I'm thinking, who owns this? Like, certainly some type of fund or institution owns it. But how many types of funds do you think are out there? I've heard you say the term thousands before, but in the US, are there literally like 10,000 private real estate funds?
You know, there's a lot of funds available in the institutional world. Certainly, you're seeing a lot of funds come out on the non-institutional world, the high net worth world. You know, most of the funds are segmented by asset class, you know, an apartment fund, industrial fund, retail fund, office fund. We're one of the few funds that's a commingled fund that we put all asset classes together. And our messaging is, we want to do smart deals. I don't care what kind of asset it is. But, you know, there's only, like I said before, the fund that mixes the private equity strategy with the direct strategy is extremely unique in our industry. But there are many, many funds out there. And I can't tell you off the top of my head exactly how many funds are out there. But it's material. There's many options out there. I think one of the challenges, when you think about the whole crowdfunding world that are out there, is how do you know that there's good underwriting being done? And when you're investing with operators and they have funds, you know, how good are they about underwriting? You know, the trust but verify thing. I mean, when you invest in people, you're trusting, but in the verification side. So, you know, one of the things we're doing, we're investing with multiple operators around the country. So we're doing that vetting process and vetting of assumptions. So a real estate guy is bringing us a deal, you know, we do that vetting on really behalf of the investors. Again, that's something that differentiates us. Most investors, when they're looking at investing in a fund, that sponsor has full autonomy to invest and stuff. There's not any kind of verification of the performance of the asset or the verification of the assumptions being made, which is a very much a differentiator overall.
Tim, just a few questions in closing. You know, for investors, can foreign citizens invest in any of MLG's funds, or is it strictly U.S. citizens?
It is complex because when you're raising money from foreign, the answer is yes, they can invest. I mean, that's a simple answer. But when that happens, is we have to research the laws of that country where the person's a citizen of, because we have to follow their rules and regulations regarding offerings. When we talk about the Jobs Act that created the ability to do general solicitation offerings in the United States, most of those offerings are viewed as public offerings in other countries. So then you have to research those rules and determine if you can make that work. It does add expense. I mean, we typically will spend, you know, it's like $3,000 to $10,000 to research whether you can, you know, take money from a certain country. So the answer is yes, but it has complexities and it has costs, real costs associated with it.
And then what's the minimum investment for your funds for now U.S. citizens? Because I'm assuming if to take money from an outsider, you might raise the minimum just to cover your cost.
Sure. You know, our unit size is $1 million per unit, which sounds big for some folks. But we don't have a technical legal minimum in our legal documents. So we encourage investors to do a minimum of 200,000. We do have the right to sell fractional units. So somebody can buy, you know, 0.2 units of one of our $1 million units to buy a fractional piece. That's okay. You know, when we've gone lower, it's been because some kind of relationship with some kind of investment group or RRA that has bringing us a larger group of investors. We'll look at some different numbers there, but in generally, we're encouraging the 200 grand investment. And if you think about, if we're buying 20 to 25 deals in each one of our funds, that's roughly $10,000 per asset. So you're not taking undue risk. You know, you have the diversification because you got the 20 to 25 deals when you're investing $200,000. And again, you're down about $10,000 per opportunity. Prior to us doing funds, our minimum was $50,000 per specific deal. So in some regards, we've actually reduced that minimum by allowing only $200,000 in our fund.
Well, Tim, you've been in this business for so long, 30 years now. You know, what's the most enjoyable part? What excites you about what you guys are doing in the real estate world?
You know, I think it's really fun to, and we interact with so many people. You know, people work hard to make their money. They spend a lifetime working the money. When they're working with us, they're not looking to roll the dice. I mean, they're looking to create a current income, create some appreciation, have some tax advantages. And it's fun to talk to people and help them, you know, meet their financial goals and just taking care of people. So really taking care of our investment clients, take good care of them and make sure that they're investing in a wise basis with us. The other thing is it's really fun, you know, being part of a larger group, you know, 300 plus employees here. And, you know, we have internship programs. I got young kids in college working here, you know, as interns. A bright young talent, and that's our main source for hiring as well. And so we have a bunch of young talent. We like to think of the folks at MLG as a big family. We were awarded the top 100 workplaces just this last year. And you know, we do fun stuff. We have a bocce court inside our office, so we play bocce.
Oh, tournaments. Nice!
Yeah, wow. It's a lot of fun. And actually, I had a tough match. I was down 6-0 and he came back and won 7-6 and stayed alive in the tournament. But it's just a way to interact with people in the company and have some fun. We have a corporate mantra around here. We like to say making a difference while making a living. We want to make money. We want to make a living, but we also will make a difference in our community, help people, and just have a great place to work and enjoy life.
Well, Tim, you're making a difference coming on our podcast and helping people understand this world of real estate and certainly this asset class. So wanted to thank you for your time. It's been a super informative and educational episode. I know the listeners will love it. I learned a ton and I'm enjoying the journey as well as being an investor in MLG. So thank you for all your work on that front and also for taking the time out of your day to day to come on and join us on Invest Like a Boss.
Hey, thank you, Sam. Appreciate your investment with us and appreciate this time today.
Right, so that's how the big bosses invest in real estate. And Sam is in the club. Well, congratulations.
John, you got to get some khaki pants, go get a membership at the local country club, and start figuring out what property funds are available for you to invest in.
I can actually imagine people in khaki pants at country clubs just talking about stuff like this all the time. And, you know, that was like the original investment podcast because you couldn't – I mean, there was no internet, you know, 10, 20 years ago.
Right.
There was no podcast, so this is how you got your information on what, like, where to put your money.
And if you had a crease in those khaki pants, forget about it. You're not getting the invitation in.
Yeah. I thought the pleated ones are good.
I think pleats maybe were cool in, like, the 80s. I don't know. I didn't wear khakis back then. I like wearing khakis, by the way. I think they're a fantastic cloth and material. It's a wonderful textile.
So a fun fact about khakis is the pants itself are actually called chinos. The color is khaki, and some people mistakenly call khakis. Just, you know, it's almost like saying like I'm wearing blue or purple.
I swear you can't make this stuff up. Only Johnny knows these fun little factoids.
Yeah, there you go. So when did you invest in them, and how has the experience been so far?
I invested in them in MLG Capital through actually one of our listeners. We started talking, I think we met in Taipei. We started talking about different assets that we're invested in. And this particular boss/listener has almost 60-70% of his assets in these types of funds, which I was like, wow, that's really surprising. Very successful guy, high net wealth. I was like, well, to have that much in, that really put it up on my radar. Like, wow, I don't have any in, so maybe I'm missing something here. And started looking at them. They're super tax advantaged for high net wealth people. And what scared me is just not having had done any of the research. Because when you start digging into this, there's literally, you know, hundreds, thousands of different potential funds. And I don't know how to really do DD on them or evaluate them. So I kind of leaned on him for a lot of the DD that he had already done, spending a lot of his free time figuring out which of these funds are the best. And this was, you know, one of his top two, top three that he recommended. Had a couple conversations, took the plunge. It's been great so far. I think, you know, now comparing to some of the early real estate investments that you and I made, Johnny, like in Fundrise, every single quarter, I still like Fundrise. I think it's a great investment for a lot of people, but every single quarter, it seems like the returns are starting to get shaved a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be like 9%, then it was like 8%. Now I feel like my returns are probably closer to 6% quarterly. And I could see that continuing to go down, where I feel like these private real estate funds are probably a lot more stable and a lot more consistent.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with the online funds is they treat them kind of like internet startups, where in the beginning, they don't worry about making money. They just want to get users on board. So it's not that they're trying to lose money, but they'll basically just, you know, get you on board either at a break even, or they'll just give you all the money. And eventually they're like, okay, now we have a reputation. Now we have, you know, 2 million users. Now let's start, you know, making money from them. And it's one of those things where I guess we're comfortable, our money's already in there, and we're like, ah, okay, you know, it was nice getting 9%. Now we're getting 7%. Oh, well, just leave it.
Man, that's a really good point. And we've seen this happen with almost every peer-to-peer platform or crowdfunding platform that we're invested in, where we got in early, kind of year one, year two, while they're making a lot of headlines. Returns were really, really good. And it's pretty much just like, it's very consistent across all of them. All the returns are becoming lower. But there is one other dynamic that is, I think, affecting that. And that is that since we've been investing in these, interest rates have been going up. Interest rates were basically 0.5 or 1% when we started investing in these. Now it's like 2.25. So I think that's also making the cost of capital a little bit more expensive and maybe bringing the returns down slightly.
Yeah, but we're the ones bringing the capital. So if anything, these funds should be worth more now because, you know, a few years ago when interest was at zero, we had nowhere else to park our money. So we would just give our money to these real estate funds to invest in, while now we can put it in, you know, even a high yield savings account and get, you know, 2.25%. So I feel like, I mean, I guess maybe some of these funds are also, they're leveraging our money. So if we,
that's right.
Let's say we put in, you know, 250 million, they borrow 750, you know, and so I guess, yeah, in that case, maybe it's getting more expensive to borrow the money, but I always kind of assumed, you know, we're like free capital for them to invest with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good points. Good points all around. Well, Johnny, I kind of found this interesting thinking back now that we have had, say, 5 years of real estate investing experience or more. What's your journey been? Because I think it's interesting thinking about how people get into real estate investing, what the first asset class is of it, and then, you know, what's the evolution of it? Because this was the last of, say, 6 layers of real estate investing that I've done. But what was the first piece of real estate that you ever owned, whether paper or physical?
So when I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, you know, years and years ago, I knew that real estate would be something I wanted to get involved in. And I just didn't have the money at the time. You know, I didn't have the investment know-how. And when I finally started making some money, I wanted to get in again. So the first thing I actually looked at was turnkey kind of rental properties. And that was with the episode with Matt Bowles of Maverick Investors. And the reason why I was so attracted to it is because he kind of just takes care of everything for you. They have these deals where like they'll guarantee the house will rent for this much, the house will appraise for this much. And kind of going through that process, I realized, okay, this is kind of the safest, easiest, most hands-free version of investing in real estate, yet I'm still afraid to pull the trigger. And I took a step back and I realized it's because I value my freedom of not having any responsibilities so much that the thought of ever needing to fly back to the US or fly anywhere to sign paperwork or to go to court for something or, you know, have to deal with, you know, a physical piece of property is like, sounds like torture to me. So I want everything to be 100% online and have it be something that I can't even visit or touch even if I wanted to.
So you, before that episode with Maverick, you had never invested in any real estate, not even a Vanguard REIT or anything like that?
So I I've never invested into a REIT, unless it happens to be in one of my broad index funds, but I've never directly invested into a REIT. I think the only thing I had invested in at the time was maybe Fundrise. Oh, no, not Fundrise, Peer Street.
Oh, right, right. So you have Peer Street, you have Fundrise, and you also, I would almost put this in real estate. It is sort of a proxy of real estate, is APH Servicing, and I think you have PPR Note now too.
Yeah, so I guess we can break all those down. Originally, I thought I was in real estate because I had all these, but most of them are more like hard money loans where they happen to be backed by real estate, but they really have nothing to do with the real estate, right? Don't get any of the benefits of appreciation. I don't get any of the tax breaks or tax benefits of the actual real estate itself. It's basically capped at whatever my interest rate is. For example, on Pier Street, most of my loans are getting between, let's say, 7% and 8% interest. And even though they're real estate backed, you know, in case someone defaults, I'm not really investing in the property. I'm investing in the note. So I guess it'd be the same with all the note funds, like PPR, PPR notes and some of these funds, where I think the only actual real estate investments where I can potentially benefit from the appreciation or the tax breaks would be like Fundrise. And I'm also in Realty Mogul as well, which is similar.
Where do you think the average person gets their first step into real estate investing? Do you think it's them I would say it's them buying their house.
I think so too. And I think most people have no idea what they're doing when they buy a house. And, you know, most people end up getting lucky because in general, you know, prices of things just go up. And, you know, when you buy a house, chances are it's going to go up at least by inflation. So 10, 20, 30 years from now, you can be like, oh, look, I have a asset that's worth $500,000. And you're going to think that was the greatest investment of your life. And for a lot of people, they wouldn't have invested or saved that money anyways. You know, people like my parents, they never would have saved, you know, $750,000, you know, in the course of their life. But because they bought a house for 150 grand and they put, you know, 2-3 grand a month in for mortgage, and it's over 30 years with inflation and the housing market growing in San Francisco, now they have a property that's worth close to $1 million. So for them, it was the best investment ever. But when I asked them how much they put in total, how much they paid in property taxes, and how much they paid in mortgage interest, and how much they paid in payments, they have no idea. They have zero clue.
I think the individual's journey in real estate investing is actually a pretty interesting one. So I just wrote down mine, and I'll also try to break it down by category afterwards. But so my first one was a condo in Thailand. So physical real estate.
Yeah.
Second one was paying off my parents' mortgage. So that was also physical real estate, I guess. Third one was I went down to Singapore and started those REIT funds, got in those Mapletree REITs. Then I went to Hong Kong and did the SE storage. So that's commercial real estate. So it'd be one, physical real estate, two, REITs, three, commercial real estate. Then, only then did I do like Vanguard funds, kind of Vanguard REITs, I would say index REITs. After that, went to crowdfunding stuff like Fundrise. And I don't know if you want to throw in kind of Peer Street, some of those other ones in there. And then also did some mortgage servicing like you. After that, PPR Note, APH Servicing. And then finally, the last pillar that I've done is, I would say, these kind of private real estate funds. But that's pretty comprehensive in the real estate. And I'm just thinking how that would compare to other people's journeys out there that have done significant real estate investing.
Yeah, I can definitely imagine someone with a super high net worth, you know, kind of going through the same journey as well, you know, whether or not it's the same order and whether or not they were nice enough to pay off their parents' mortgage. So good on you for that. But I can imagine that these are kind of like the things that people would invest in. And to be honest, I want to be slightly more in real estate. I know I've talked about this so many times on so many episodes, but the BRRRR strategy, the buy, you know, like when you like buy a kind of distressed property or kind of crappy property, you refurbish it, rehab it to make it better, raise the rents so it's worth more. You refinance, take all your or most of your original money out, and then you can basically just, you know, have a source of passive income, or you can flip it after, you know, a few years. This model it just sounds so good. Like, it has so many tax advantages. It's, you know, such a good way of just creating money. And it's actually good for the world where you're buying kind of crappy properties. You're buying the worst house in the, you know, in a good neighborhood, and you're fixing it up to be on par with the other ones. You know, it's actually good for society as well. So yeah. I really want to get into this, but it's such a big obligation. Usually, you know, most people who are doing it as a part-time job or even a full-time job. They're living in the US. They're living kind of close by where that's being done. Or they have a team who does it. And it's almost like a full-time career. So I would really like to find an online fund that does this, but where I would still get benefits of the tax benefits as well as possible appreciation. And I don't know if we actually get that with anything that we're in.
Yeah, I would like to have a really high net wealth person on that really focuses a lot of their investment allocation to real estate funds, because I think there's basically a way. Let's just say you're investing $10 million or strip it down to $1 million for different comparables. But let's say you had $10 million and you put it all into funds like MLG Capital, right? If it produces a 8% preferred return, that means it's creating an income stream of $800,000 a year. I believe all of that can be all the gains and the taxes can be mitigated through depreciation and other types of write-offs. So you effectively get an $800,000 a year tax-free income stream. Now, you would pay tax later when those properties flip or sold. However, most of these funds have it so that what's the term 1031C?
Yeah, the 1031 exchange.
Yeah, 1031 exchange. So that when that fund is wound up, you would have that gain, but then they'll have a new fund that you can roll it in through a 1031 exchange. So hypothetically, you could do this for the rest of your life and never have a taxable gain. I would assume then whoever you pass that on to through inheritance might have a gain. I'm not sure how it would work, but I'm pretty sure you could, if you went all into this asset class, you could have an incredible income stream tax-free for really the rest of your life as long as you had some strategy behind it.
Yeah, I really love that. And that is exactly what I want, to be able to take advantage of those, of, you know, basically the depreciation of being able to take advantage of the 1031 exchange. These are things that by me investing in, for example, Pure Street or notes, I'm not getting that benefit. And I think I potentially am missing out a lot on this. But at the same time, the biggest problem is there are two types of investors, you know, really. There are people who just do real estate, and then there's people who basically do everything else, and they do a little bit of real estate, but it's not really their focus. And I feel like both sides think the other side's an idiot, where they don't really and they don't really communicate about it. And there's no, you know, and you know, I'm sure there's pros and cons of both sides, but it's so hard to get like good, easy information on it. Like, what are we actually missing out on?
Yeah. And there's so many ways to play it too. Like if you want to be fully passive and not have to worry about things like you, and if you want to be fully hands-on and try to make much more of a margin, there's just different tools for different jobs, right? So you got to find your own quest, your own pathway to real estate. But you know, we all agree that it's a fantastic asset class, always has been, and probably in our lifetime always will be, but we'll see. But hope everyone enjoyed that episode. I learned a lot. I'm definitely going to re-listen to this a couple times. And if anyone has insights into other funds that are great, let's chat about it in the Boss Lounge.
Yeah, definitely let us know, especially if you guys happen to find something that is for either non-accredited investors or something maybe that's an online fund, something maybe with a lower limit. Or if you guys know something like Realty Mogul or Fundrise takes advantage of any of these tax savings. I'm also curious, maybe at the end of the year when you do your taxes next year, how much of that, you know, those gains or the 8% actually is write-offable, because I think all these things are really, really exciting on paper. But then at the end of the year, you know, when we finally do taxes, the questions are how big of a pain in the butt was it? And then how much do you actually save? Because so I really want to know that as well.
Sounds great. Well, actually, isn't tax season now? Oh, I got an extension on mine. Did you do an extension on yours?
I had to do an extension on mine too, because mine is overly complicated. So this is a big warning, is by having 24 different investments and like, you know, 10 different 1099s coming in, it makes it a huge pain in the ass. So be careful to getting too excited.
Yeah, We should do a dedicated episode once we figure out all this. Mine's going to be nasty as well this year, but yeah. We'll compare notes. That was fun. Good episode.
Yeah, that's fun. Thanks, guys, for leaving all these great reviews of the podcast and for telling your friends about Invest Like a Boss. You're the reason why we get great guests and more people find the show. So if you haven't yet, go on iTunes, leave us a 5-star review. And if you leave a review, you get access to the Boss Lounge for free. So just go to Facebook, type in Boss Lounge, look for Invest Like a Boss, and we'll see all of you next week. And see you in Lithuania, Sam.
Vilnius. See you guys.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.
You like things just so. So do we. The Bank of Clark is the bank for that. We all have an inner perfectionist who deserves things done their way. Maybe you like to bank in person. Maybe you prefer to bank online. We get it. From banking to lending to wealth management, we're all about getting things done just the way you like them. We're the bank for that. Find out what banking designed for you is all about. Visit your local Bank of Clark branch today or go to bankofclark.bank. We're the bank for that. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.